You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
So what are we smoking this week, Brad?
Well, this week we've got the Macanudo Inspirado Black. And we've talked about the Inspirado, but I think it had more of a... It wasn't a natural wrapper, it was...
I think it was the Habano wrapper, maybe?
Yeah,
Inspirado Red a couple episodes ago. So we're like, that's a pretty good cigar. Not because, you know, Macanudo is kind of known for their more... milder cigar, so it had a lot of flavor but not a lot of strength. But now we said I had to step it up to the Inspirado Black, which is a dark as shit Maduro.
Yeah, so this
is got a little bit more, or at least they say it has a little bit more strength to it.
Yeah, so this is going to have a Connecticut broadleaf wrapper with a Ecuadorian Sumatra binder with Nicaraguan Esteli filler, and they're saying it's full. As of right now, just in the first third, I'm going to agree. You know, this pack's a bit of a wallop for a Macanudo, which, you know, I'm happy.
Yeah, they're saying it's made with proprietary seeds, grown in Esteli, and uniquely fermented, which produces the utmost in strength and flavor. Which, you know, like I said, I normally shy away from Macanudo because of they're a little weak for my palate, but so far this has got a nice little kick to it.
Yeah, I mean off the bat, I would classify this, you know, they go on to say that, you know, there should be a balance of bold peppery notes and a subtle undertone of sweet earth. I haven't been able to bite off a chunk of earth yet to quite understand what sweet earth really is, but I mean, I guess we could go and get a handful of clay and bite into it and
ask some rock biters, you know, what earth tastes like.
I don't know. Maybe something for the flat earthers to put their mouth around. I don't know. but I mean, you know, like you said, typically, you know, this far in, and it's like, all right, it's already going to be light. So, I mean, this one already separates itself from the pack. And it's, you know, it's an all right cigar. I mean, you know, the one thing about Macanudo I'll give them is, you know, their price points. I mean, it seems that, you know, they shoot to strive for that, you know, $8.50 to $9 mark. And, you know, to me, that's, you know, I'm getting a lot of value, you know, at that point for my smoking experience.
Yeah, and it's, you know, despite their lacking in strength to me, they've always got good flavor. And, like, so their blends are, I can see why it's such a popular smoke. So this week, we're kind of going to the future, to the past, a mix of both.
Yeah, we're going down nostalgia road.
Yeah.
I mean, for anybody that likes geek culture, and you're probably not listening to this podcast if you don't, you know, like some sort of, you know, geek culture. So,
yeah, for the last, I don't know, year since it was announced, we've been talking about Ready Player One becoming a movie, and it finally did a thing. So we're going to be talking about Ready Player One this week. And if you're going to stay up for one of those all-night gaming sessions, you really need to call into the Strike Force. StrikeForceEnergy.com. You know, use your promo code CigarNerds for 20% off your order. Comes in a nice little pouch. You can, you know, pour it in your coffee, your water, your beer, whatever you want. It will keep you all. You don't need the cans. You can, like, stuff a whole bunch of those in your pocket and go to the arcade if those things still exist.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, shout out to Flashback Games, and I mean, you know, and to some extent, you know, Dave and Buster's for a new era of arcades. It's so crazy to go to arcade and everything is all LCD and everything now. I'm like
swiping cards instead of having to carry like rolls of quarters. That is what we're talking about this week. So fire up your Atari 2600, you know, drop a quarter in the slot and get ready to game.
Mm-hmm. Ready? Like a one. Like a ran. And MC's awesome. Let's face it, I love the Oasis. 2044 and the world is in stasis. And every time I look up at the headline news, there's a down and out plastic and red line blues. Holiday hit the prize, I'm a worthy disciple. Sixes on my back, they're aware that I might go. Psycho and Daito and Artemis. H, you know we really put a heart in this.
On a mission for this egg like Easter Sunday. Three secret gates that will open one day. With extended color, basic mode of 300 baud. Nostalgic for the 80s, all of this kind of odd. All about feeding jazz, get that copper key. Saw you flick sync war games perfectly. Through the dungeons of Daggerith, Wade attacks. Second for the win, no, I've always got your back.
Three hidden keys.
Open three secret gates.
Where the player will be tested.
For worthy traits.
And those with the skill.
Who survive these straits.
Will reach the end.
Where the prize awaits.
Three hidden keys.
Open three secret gates.
Where the player will be tested.
For worthy traits.
And those with the skill.
Who survive these straits.
Will reach the end.
Where the prize awaits.
I'm reading Gaiman, Tolkien. Guess what happened? 42 mistakes like Douglas Adams. I fell in love with a girl, but it felt so wrong. A game within a game, within a white stripe song. And she turned me down when I tried to court her. Beat Pac-Man, found a secret court. J-Key now, but his IOI dorks. We'll be blowing the gap, the crunch whistle playing Zork.
But I see you putting work like your name was Neil Peart. Or Getty Lee, Meek Lee, inheriting the earth. I heard you played the riff and it sounded really nice, son. Parsifal's been standing up on lots of Alex's life, son. Did administrative data when they caught it all on camera. Staring at these screens, I've been losing all my stamina. Good thing you've been standing up on 2112. Because we couldn't get the crystal key with anyone else.
Three hidden keys.
Open three secret gates.
Where the player will be tested.
For worthy traits.
And those with the skill.
To survive these straits.
Will reach the end.
Where the prize awaits.
Three hidden keys.
Open three secret gates.
Where the player will be tested
for worthy traits.
And those with the skill
to survive these straits
will reach the end
where the prize awaits.
Mega Godzilla versus Ultraman. Cataclysm explosion and the fun began. To make a long story short, no, I couldn't fail. When the game's holy grail was the holy grail. Keys in the hole like lethal charity. Finally a final egg, I need therapy. Artemis and I, well, we finally kissed. Sorrento got arrested, the prize was split.
And I know you were surprised when we met in real life. Secrets were exposed once hidden online. The Oasis was one big wonderwall. So we finally unplugged, but that's not all. We did some interviews at Ogden's crib. Guess it all worked out for these nerdy kids. Now we chill in the clubhouse playing D&D. Roger Rabbit on repeat, yes, it's good to be a geek.
Three hidden keys.
Open three secret gates.
Where the player will be tested.
For worthy traits.
And those with the skill.
To survive these straits.
Will reach the end.
Where the prize awaits.
Three hidden keys.
Open three secret gates.
Where the player will be tested.
For worthy traits.
And those with the skill.
To survive these straits.
Will reach the end.
Where the prize awaits.
And welcome to the main topic. Are you ready, player one?
Challenge accepted.
Press start now.
Yeah, you don't see
Mortal Kombat,
which is one of the many, many references we will get into. So I guess with no further ado, I mean, you can't talk about the movie without first talking about the novel that inspired the movie. So, you know, from here on out, folks, if you haven't read the book or seen the film, I mean, you're just doing yourself a disservice. Go and, you know, either get the audiobook like we talked about, you know, in the last episode, narrated by Will Wheaton, or, you know, go and see the film. You know, both share similar likenesses, but, you know, kind of the way the film progresses is a little bit different than the story. And, you know, and some of the reviews and some of the feedback and talking about Ready Player One, you know, people were kind of upset by that dynamic that, you know, the movie wasn't a direct follow of the book. And
we'll, you know, yeah, kind of delve into that a little deeper as it goes on. But the one thing I did like about it is it's, you know, even though it did not follow the original story, the book Ready Player One, written in 2011 by Ernest Cline, he's also the one of the writers of the screenplay for the movie. So the movie was written by the, you know, person who wrote the original source material. So it's almost like giving him like a second shot at his creation. Cause a lot of times, you know, some Hollywood writer comes in and it just, you know, completely fucks up the source material. but this, you know, at least had enough elements of that source material that it felt true to the heart of the story, but at the same time making it different enough that if you were a diehard fan of the book, you're not just getting the exact same thing. You know, it was like, you know, shit, here's a new story. You know, enough entertaining that I didn't know what was, you know, I knew how it was going to end, obviously, but how they got there was, you know, different than the original story.
Absolutely. So let's just go ahead and, you know, just recap real briefly. So, you know, basically the story is set in 2044. Earth is a very crummy, shitty place. Hard to imagine, you know, fast forwarding the 2044 and this maybe not becoming a reality. But basically, reality sucks. So people choose to spend most of their time in a virtual video game world called the Oasis. And
yeah, where you can live, you can work, you can game. Because in the real world, it's like post-energy crisis. Like every bad environmental worry we've had, like, has come true. Wars have broken out over, you know, resources and whatnot, and pretty much like either you're the super rich living in like mega cities, or you're like, you know, in skyscraper-esque trailer parks that are just,
yeah, where, you know, basically overpopulation, you know, has become a thing. And I mean, you see that in you know, like modern day Japan. You know, you don't have the landmass to have the urban sprawl, so what do? You build up instead of out. So, you know, I mean, very, you know, kind of intriguing looking at it from that thing. But I mean, you know, the big catch for Ready Player One is the nostalgia factor. And, you know, if you want to trip down memory lane, if you've ever been a video game, a pop culture enthusiast or anything, I mean, since, you know, we winding back to the early 80s up through, you know, the present time, both the book and the film have something to offer everyone.
And that was one of the things too. Reading the book, that was, you know, I know people of, you know, kind of our generations, you know, really dug it. But I was like, there's so many hardcore 80s references that I'm like, there's certain people in the audience that are just too young to get this book.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you've seen, you know, franchises like Star Wars, you know, have to branch out. You know, there's a whole new generation that probably, you know, has a different view and, you know, different experiences that aren't going to relate to our generation. So, you know, things have to adapt in order to attract a, you know, new group, you know.
And that was one thing in the movie version, too, is it wasn't so 80s-centric. It did have a lot of 80s stuff, but it kind of expanded a little bit. There was a little bit more 90s, I would say, references in there than it was like straight up 80s.
Yes,
the thing
absolutely.
In the book did, you know, not strictly stick to the 80s. There was some shit from, you know, later down the road. I mean, there's Firefly references, so that's, you know, yeah, definitely not in the 80s.
Just 20 years ago. Instead of 30.
Oh, my heart. I'm feeling old. Oh.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. This is going to be a trip down memory lane. So if you're a video gamer, a movie enthusiast or anything, this is going to be the episode for you. So, you know, as we follow Wade through his journey of finding the Easter egg that...
Yeah, if anybody's not familiar with the book, basically video game designer who is basically almost like the Bill Gates or who's the Apple guy?
Steve Jobs,
that guy. He's like, you know, develops this. He's a game designer and eventually builds this virtual world that becomes so popular because, like I said, everybody's kind of fleeing the real world to live in that. He becomes like the richest man on the planet, but he is like an uber nerd and didn't have any relationships, kids or whatever. And like the last part of his life, he pretty much just became a hermit and, like, you know, just lived in his castle in his virtual world. And he dies with no heirs and no one to take over his company. So he devises this game within the game that if you can find three keys that unlock three gates that will eventually lead you to this Easter egg, if you solve all my tests of worthy traits, you will get my company and control the Oasis and all of my trillions of dollars and basically become, like, you know, ruler of the virtual world.
Yep, where you decide its fate. You know, and that's kind of a, you know, a cool concept. And I mean, you know, you look at a lot of the MMORPGs, and that's very much how the Oasis operates. And I mean, you know, to bring it back to, you know, more relatable terms. Okay, so, you know, imagine World of Warcraft, you know, 10 years ago, set with a Oculus, you know, modern technology, yeah, you know, design. And
Yeah, and the Quest is so, like... Like, he was obsessed with 80s, 90s pop culture and nerd stuff. So once he devises this riddles and these clues and these tests, you know, everyone... They're all, like, based on the things that he loved. So all these, like, next generation of people study the 80s like it's a college course because they need to watch and learn and know everything he knew to be able to find this treasure. So inside the Oasis, it's pretty much, you know, 80s, 90s video game land.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, everything referenced from the Atari 2600 to, oh, my God, just a endless plethora of, you know, other video games. I think Adventure was also referenced, The Perfect Game of Pac-Man.
Because if anyone doesn't know, Adventure was the first instance of a Easter egg in a video game. The designer, because back then, you know, nowadays designers kind of, you know, become famous, but back then, the programmers were just, you know, faceless people behind the game. So he hid his name inside the game. And that was the first Easter egg. If you were able to find the secret room with the secret key, you got to see the designed by whoever it was. Now I can't remember.
Yeah, and you know, so it's pretty cool. I mean, I don't know. Easter eggs are always a fun thing, and sometimes you even get, you know, the unbeknownst Easter egg. What's really great is the Easter eggs that appear, and, you know, the game publisher is like, what? That wasn't supposed to be there.
The first ones I remember as a kid was... Because, you know, Atari was, you know, a little bit before my... You know, I had one because it was my dad's from when he was a kid. But, you know, I grew up on original Nintendo and Super Nintendo were my first systems. And I remember Mortal Kombat 2. I believe it was Mortal Kombat 2. Had, like, a bunch of, like, hidden stuff in it. And I remember one day there was one where... When you hit the start button and the screen started, if you held down like all like most of the buttons, like the top trigger buttons and everything while the game loaded, you'd get this little animation of Goro coming out and smashing the sign and doing stuff. And it was like, I was just holding the controller waiting for the damn game to start. And all of a sudden this new thing, I was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah. It's almost like, you know, in modern games where like sometimes at the loading screens, they're like interactive. So you can get your character and go explore, you know, while... It's like to take your mind off that, crap, this thing takes 3 minutes to load.
Yeah, because now in the like days of internet, you know, you can find a hint to find all these Easter eggs like, you know, fairly quickly after a game comes out. But back in the day when you found something, you're like, oh, my God, I wonder if anybody else knows of this. It's just, it was much harder to find Easter eggs back in our day.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, people would buy what the Nintendo Power magazines, you know, and... You know, I think eventually, you know, Game Informer, and then, you know, you started having companies, you know, as games became more and more involved, actually releasing, you know, full-on strategy guides, which to me, you know, always kind of defeated the purpose. I mean, it was almost like when the Game Shark came out, and it was like, you know, why do I want all these cheat codes and everything? Like, you know, which... You know, later on, as games progress, like Grand Theft Auto, you know, okay, well, whatever. I just want to, you know, cause as much mayhem as possible. Like, all right, you know.
I'm tired of dying and losing all my shit. I need the God code. But yeah, in the book, the people who were hunting the Easter egg are called Gunters. And, you know, there's... The book really follows one character. It's all told from his perspective of Wade Owen Watts, aka Parsival. And the thing about the book versus the movie is things are so more drawn out in the book versus the movie, which you can't like, you know, like in the book. I mean, I think there's like 5-6
months.
Well,
I mean, I think in the book, like you're a good hour in before the, you know, first key is ever even discovered. Like,
yeah, out of 40 chapters, I think it's like he doesn't get the first key to like chapter 15. There's a whole lot more world building of explaining like, you know, what this is, how we got here. We're in a movie. You can just kind of visually show that real quick and not take as much time. But then even when he finds like the first key, there's like 5 or 6 months between that and him finding the next key. So it's like where the book probably takes place over, I'd say over maybe a year's time. Like the movie felt like it occurred over 2 or 3 days. It was like a much like shorter
timeline.
Much
compressed time frame, yeah. But I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. It was just... from a film perspective, I mean, it works. I mean, you know, if they were to draw it out and, you know, you would lose interest or, you know.
That to end.
Like the way you went about the keys was also
that's what I was about to say. Because in the book, it's not just finding the key. You find the key unlocks a gate. And then, so there's like really like six tests you have to go through before you ever get to the final boss battle. Because you got to find the key, then you got to find the gate that goes with the key, because they're not together. There's like, you find the key, you get a clue, takes you to the next thing, it gives you a clue till you find the next key. Where in the movie, it's like the keys were the thing themselves. You find all three keys will unlock the final gate to get to the Easter egg. So there was like a lot more stuff they had to do, but I can understand why they had to change how he got the keys in the movie versus the book, because
you had really to make want to watch cinematic. Somebody play Joust for, you know.
Yes, like a lot of the tests were either him reenacting movies or playing old video games. And it's like, well, I don't know, in this generation of people watching Twitch, maybe that could have been something cinematic, is just watching a guy playing Atari for an hour. But yeah, it's like they had to make it more action oriented or visually appealing than just, you know, watch, you know, reading about a guy playing a video game against a monster sounds pretty cool. But yeah,
although I would have loved to, you know, seen the part where, you know, he has to recite the lines from Monty Python, like
yeah, because in the book they develop a whole, it's like a, like as soon as he finds the key and it's like, oh, you have to reenact this movie line by line, and kind of generated a whole new game of interactive cinema. That's something I'd almost like to do. Like if I
you well, I mean, you
put
know,
on the Oculus and be a character in one of my favorite movies. That's actually a
but I mean,
cool
like
idea.
You know, we play the game Flux, and the only thing about the game of Flux is the rules constantly change. So we've actually got a Monty Python version of it where it asks you to, you know, sing songs and interact, you know, do interactive stuff, and like. That's kind of difficult, like, you know, to be like, okay, off the cuff, I've got to, you know, now recite this line by line, or, you know, remember, cause, and then it's like, crap, pressure's on.
But yes, 2018's Ready Player One, directed by Steven Spielberg, written by Zach Penn and Ernest Cline. I mean, it's made for $175 million, which is a lot for a video, you know, it's
probably most of that went to get intellectual property rights.
Yeah, because one thing we said is like, how are they going to make this the movie? Because there's so many like pop culture references to various, you know,
entities
and companies and stuff. But then we're like, oh, Steven Spielberg, because like his name is big enough where he can be like, hey, can I use this? Here's a bunch of money. But so far, I mean, it's made $403 million. It's still in. It's only been out like what, 2 weeks. It's already the fourth largest opening of the year, next to like whatever Black Panther and a couple others. But yeah, it is like a huge. It's a Steven Spielberg movie, so you know it's huge. And it's like, I don't think anyone else could have treated the source material as well as, because you know Steven Spielberg has been, you know, fueling our imagination for freaking as hell as long as I've been alive. So, I mean, I think, you know, he's about the only one I think that could pull off such an epic, you know, story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, this is definitely, you know, a film for the underdogs. I mean, you know, here you've got major entities, you know, you've got the Gunters, you've got, you know, another clan called the Sixers, you've got, you know, a, you know, rogue, you know, business owner, Nolan Sorrento, who wants to, you know, basically, I don't know. He's basically the EA.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know. He's the guy that, because Gregarious Games is the one who built the Oasis, the one that Ogden
Morrow
and James Halliday created. But then there's the IOI Corporation, which is like basically they're the ones that like want to monetize as much, charge you a user's fee, charge you for downloadable content, send you freaking pop-up ads out the wazoo. And, you know, they're the ones who are trying to they're the evil empire, and they want to gain control of the Oasis, but unfortunately they're, you know, held to the same rules as we are, as they have to, you know, find the Easter egg, but
they've got billions of dollars, yes. And, you know,
so they either hire gamers to work for them and basically cheat, because like they have a whole research lab that can tell people, try to analyze the stuff and give them all kind of like resources and backup. And even in the book, he's like, you know, supposedly like one avatar can't be another avatar, but they're like, hey, we own all the avatars, so if, you know, whoever my best man is, I can stick in this avatar. And that's how they all are called Sixers, because they all have the same generic default avatar. And instead of a name, they have their, you know, user number, which all starts with like sixes. So that's why they call this. But I do like versus the book versus the movie, they looked a lot cooler. Because in the book, they're described as basically guys in like blue jumpsuits with like, you know, a name tag of their number in the same generic white male avatar. But in the game, or in the movie, they all look like robots with like a freaking digital their number on their, they look the same like default, like they almost kind of look like the robots from Chappie.
Yes. Yeah, and I mean, you know, so you've got all these opposing forces, and then you've got our reluctant, you know, Wade obviously being the main character, you know, Parsifal, but then you've got Artemis, you've got H.
Tyler Sheridan as Wade Watts, Olivia Cooke as Samantha Cooke, a.k.a. Artemis, Ben Mendelsohn as Sorrento, Lena Waithe as H., T.J. Miller as I-Rock, and Simon Pegg as Odin Morrow, and Mark Rylance as James Halliday, and then, of course, Shoto and Daito. But... yeah, the character of I-Rock too. Like when I saw the movie, I completely forgot there was an I-Rock in the book until I went back and reread the book, because he's such a small character in the book. He's been, because basically H is like a celebrity in the Oasis. He's like a competitive, like whatever deathmatch fighter, and has the money to like travel and hunt. Where Wade is, Percival's kind of like stuck on his like home planet of, because pretty much.
Yeah, there's a school in the Oasis and everything, and
he has no money to go anywhere else. So, and he's like a low level character, where his buddy has got all kind of money, but they, you know, became friends of their knowledge and stuff. So he builds this, call it like a chat room, but it's basically like a basement arcade.
Basement.
It's like a man cave basement arcade. And I-Rock is like one of the douchebags that hang out there, and he ends up, you know, getting Wade busted by like letting people know that him and H are like students. So they're able to, IOI is able to bribe somebody and get their IDs from the school.
Real world identities.
Yeah, you know, which is supposed to be, you know, illegal, but you know, they bribe a freaking teacher. But in the movie, he's this big badass bounty hunter that IOI like hires to like hunt down Parsifal and the rest of the gamers. And it's completely hilarious, because when you see him, he's this big hulking burly character with guns, and his torso is like a skull. But he talks like T.J. Miller.
Yes.
Just this voice and the crap he talks out coming out of this like scary looking dude. It just makes it even funnier.
Yeah, which is, you know, I mean, it just, and to just be able to visualize everything, you know, was just, you know, freaking amazing. You know, putting names with faces and everything else. And I mean, it was definitely a nostalgic, like, I mean, just reading the book and seeing the movie was almost a nostalgic experience. Like, you know, here you are seeing this thing come to fruition, come to real life. And I don't know, I love some of the, you know, takes and differences that they did with the characters, you know, like in the book, you know, they don't meet each other until very, you know, late into, you know,
yeah, they don't meet each other in the real world until,
but, you know,
like,
here,
right, like the final battle, where this one they kind of meet each other like maybe halfway through.
Yeah,
have a little bit more real world, because like with the book, it's told like pretty much from first person perspective of Parsifal, and the other people are, they're there, but they're not like the focus of the story. Where this, they gave each of the characters a little more purpose.
Yeah,
because like in the book, you know, at one point, yeah, the final key is like locked behind a force field. Like the IOI people get there first and just sequester the planet. So Parsifal allows himself to be Because they have a thing like, you know, indentured servitude, where if you end up owing money to the company, they can actually enslave you and make you work, you know, in as, you know, free labor in the Oasis. So he goes undercover and gets all this information and finds a way to destroy the gate. But where in this one, you know, it's Artemis who ends up getting captured, and, you know, and they have to like rescue her. So it's like, you know, the things happen, but it kind of happens to like different characters.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and the coming of age, you know, both in the book, I mean, you know, the book, you know, really revolves around the relationship development between Wade and Artemis. And, you know, in the movie, you know, that's very much a thing, you know, where, you know, once you make it on the leaderboard, basically at that point, you're, you know, you're hunted, and, you know, people know that, oh, this guy, you know, is special. And, you know, you see an IOI come through and, you know, bomb the stacks and, you know, everything and, you know, over a freaking video game. Like,
yeah,
I mean, you know, the whole level of corporate greed is, you know, a whole nother level.
And I do like the that scene too, because that is as much different as there was between the movie and the book. That threatening scene was pretty much straight from the book, because, you know, once Wade gets on the board, he gets invited to Sorrento, meet Sorrento in the virtual world, and he's like, "Don't know who I am. I'll at least show up and see what he wants, and then tell him to fuck off. It'll be funny." So, you know, he shows up and he gives him the whole like, you know, speech, like, "Yeah, come join us. Yeah, we'll pay you all this money." And he's like, being a smart, like, "I'll tell you what, if the company fires you and gives me your job, I'll do it." And then he's like, "Nah, fuck, I'm still not going to do it." And you're like, "Well, you know, you might want to pay attention to what I'm offering, Wade." And he's like, "Fuck, did you just call me by my real name?"
Yeah.
Because he, like, you know, basically has a whole little man cave in a van off site from his home that he exists in. But they don't know that. And, you know, they, since they've tracked him down, know where he actually lives, they're like, "You can either join us or we'll kill you." And, you know, luckily he's not home at the time, but they blow up his entire stack of buildings and kill countless people and his aunt that he's living with. And that's when you know, like, oh shit, stuff's just getting deadly serious. People will literally kill for the information I know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's crazy too. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you hear a lot, you know, in modern times about collusion with different countries and, you know, groups of hackers and botters, and it kind of makes you wonder, like,
Yeah, and it's even, I mean, in the book, it's much darker than that, because even, what is it, they actually find Daito and throw him out of a window, you know, right in the middle of a battle for, like, I think it's the second key. You know, they snatch him out, you know, people actually find out where he lives and, like, snatch him out of his apartment, throw him off the balcony, make it look like a suicide. So it's like, you know, in the movie they didn't, because I was like, didn't he die in the book? Like, I had to go back and reread the book. Like, yeah. Oh yeah, that guy died. He didn't make it to the final battle. But, you know, in the movie, you know, they didn't want to kill off the random Japanese guy.
But I mean, they make such a good, you know, dynamic. And I mean, that's what I'm saying, is I think the film, you know, definitely had its, you know, throwbacks and its, you know, hints to the book. But I mean, like we said earlier, to try to do the book and to just watch people, you know, play and battle for these keys in, you know, Joust and in Pac-Man and Adventure, it just wouldn't, you know, quite work.
I mean, the book has a whole chapter about him buying a love doll and spending a month in a freaking virtual brothel. So, I mean,
hey, man, you know.
Kind of, you know, shortened up the storyline a little bit.
I mean, when we get full haptic suits and, you know, everything else, like, you know, I thought, and I mean, there's hints to it in the movie, you know, like when him and Artemis make it to, you know, the big anti-gravity dance and everything, and, you know, Artemis actually touches him for the first time and, like, you know, "Can you feel that? You know, can you feel this?" And he's like, "Oh God."
Yeah, because I do like, because we, in the book, it's the first key is, you know, him playing through a Dungeon and Dragons thing and then having to play the game Joust. Well, in the movie, it starts off with this epic race, which that's one thing we were talking about, how many different reference as they are in the book, how they're going to, like, they do it in the movie. Because in just in this opening sequence of the race, you see so many avatars from different games and movies and stuff walking around. But then they get into the race. Like, all the Sixers, who all their stuff look the same, have, like, looks like blacked out NASCARs. But H is driving Bigfoot.
Yes.
Wade is driving a
DeLorean.
No, wait. It's the Back to the Future DeLorean, but it has the Knight Rider AI lights in the front and, like, Ghostbuster logos on it. And Artemis has the Acura light cycle. But the other racers, you see the Mach 5, you see Christine, you see, like, an Ecto-1 and an A-Team van, like, all this shit in this epic, like, freaking death battle race.
And that was kind of the thing. Like, when we saw the trailer...
And you get attacked by King Kong. Yeah,
and you know, we saw the race, and it's like, how does this even fit or tie in? But the way that they did Holiday and, you know, basically his museum with the curator and everything, like, and, you know, they show that clip, and it's like, you know, I've did a lot in life, but, you know, sometimes I just wish I could go, you know, back as fast as possible, you know? And
yeah, because in the book, everybody has a basically an almanac. It's, you know, Anorax Almanac, who has, like, every movie, every speech, everything about Halliday. It's like a complete... But, yeah, again, you're not going to watch people reading a freaking Kindle in a book. So they build this giant, like, library dedicated to Halliday that has all that information in it and has, like, actual virtual recreations of, you know, his life and stuff. And that is so, like, you know, he's constantly going back there to do research. And it's, instead of, you know, reading about stuff, it's, you know, the characters who play Halliday and Ogden, you know, acting this stuff out. And that's where he finds, like, a lot of his clues. But, yeah, that whole thing is, like, pretty much him having to fire his partner who started it with, because they kind of started disagreeing over where everything was going. And he's just like, yeah, I just wish you could go backward, like, as fast as I can. Just really put the pedal to the metal. And he's like, oh, shit. And, like, why do we all have to go the same? Let me throw it in reverse and back up this race and see what happens. And, of course, he finds a freaking warp zone and... There's a safe way to the exit without having to, you know, go through all the traps of the race. So it's like,
but I mean, you know,
there's been a few games like that where, you know, the 2D side scrollers, you pretty much always think you have to go to the right, but, like, occasionally if you just turn around and went to left, you would find some kind of, like, secret life or secret thing hidden in it. It was very much like an old game.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, just the. I don't know, man. I mean, it was just freaking awesome, you know, seeing, you know, Kong and the magnitude. Like, I was like, well, shit, you know, they're doing this with Kong. This looks badass. Hell, there might be, you know, a shot for Rampage.
Haven't seen it yet.
Not me either, but I'm like, you know, like, shit, that could work. But, you know, I mean, you know, him saving, you know, Artemis at the end, because it's like, you know, nobody makes it past Kong, and, you know, I don't know. It was kind of cool. I mean, like I said.
And H in the movie versus the book, too, is cool. He's, you know, as we'll find out later, you know, H is actually, you know, a woman, you know, same way they revealed it in the book. But he's like a Oasis mechanic and builds, like, stuff for people, so... Yeah, he takes Artemis to him to fix her bike that's trashed in the race. But he's building, like, a life-size Iron Giant and has all kind of cool... Like, you know, it wasn't as much as his basement thing, but it was kind of throwaways to it. I remember there's, like, one scene where he's actually going out on dancing with Artemis, and he's, like, trying to find out what he's going to wear. And, like, there's this cool fireplace, and, like, the posters on the wall around them. There's the... whatever, the election poster from Back to the Future. There's, like, all these cool, like, little movie posters. There's even, like, I think a poster of Will Wheaton in that scene, who narrates who's, you know, in the book and also narrates the book.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really, I mean, when you think nerd culture, I mean, you know, he's kind of the epitome, you know, of that, I mean.
Oh, because, yeah, in the book, he's like the, how was it, the, like, Oasis Players Union or something. Yeah, he has some kind of, like, elected job in the book.
I, you know, but, I mean, it's just, visually, just, I mean, it was one of the few films that 3D really worked well for, because, you know, the way that they did the screenplay when they're in the Oculus, I mean, it just, you really, you know, feel that level of immersion, and you know, has that video game-esque feel to it. It's like, you know, why can't we have modern 3D?
Oh, yeah.
You know, like it's like, this is what I want for the Oculus.
Yeah, and when he gets the first key, it comes with, like, you know, a lot of credits. And not only that, is he like, you know, signs all these endorsement deals with people and starts making money, kind of like he did in the book. But a kid who's been poor all his life suddenly gets money. Yeah, you know, he does pretty much what all of us would do. He's like, you're going through the virtual mall, like, oh my God, I need this. You know, he's like, oh, I'm going to buy like a brand new computer, and I'm getting the full haptic, state of the art haptic suit with, like, you know, the groin cup and everything, and some kind of, like, whatever, freaking magical Rubik's cube and the holy hand grenade.
Yes. Which, you know, I mean, what do you do? You know, I mean, like you said, you know, when you begin an RPG and you have nothing, you know, and then all of a sudden you know, reach kind of end game content and you have, you know, credits or, you know, badass armor and stuff. Like, I that was one of the cool things I loved about, you know, Irock's character. He's like, dude, I'm storing like 10 years worth of artifacts and shit inside me. Like, you can't kill me.
Yeah, because that's one of the, and I do like all these little items that he picked up, like, comes back. Because it, when they're trying to find the second key, he, there's something about the clue that reminds him of Kira, who is Ogden's wife. But apparently she had went out on a date with Halliday, and that was the one woman he loved and regret, like, not taking her dancing or whatnot. And he makes a bet with, there's this little robot curator of the museum, who's like, I bet you there's this right here is the only reference. This has got to be the clue, because this is the only reference to carry in the entire database. And he's like, no, it's not. And he's like, I bet you, you know, all my money that this is the only reference to her. So he searches, he's like, huh, you win. Here you go. And, like, throws him, like, a freaking quarter. And he's like, okay, a quarter, sweet. Yeah. In the movie, he had to, or in the book, he had to play a, you know, perfect game of Pac-Man to get that quarter. But yeah. But yeah, and they end up, you know, because like I said, they in the book, some of his trials is he has to reenact a movie. Well, the second key is hidden inside
The Shining.
The Shining, which, like, that was cool, because, I mean, it, when they went in there, it looked like they were in The Shining. I mean, and we, like I said, we recently rewatched that, you know, however many months ago for an episode. So it was, I was like, oh shit, they're in The Shining. This is awesome. And H ends up in the room with the naked lady who turns into like a hideous zombie witch thing. it was such a weird ass. And I do like when the IOI people end up getting to that part. You see the room just full of all these Sixers in their
like terrified out of their mind, because it's like, have none of you seen The Shining? Like,
like he asks like the ninja, you know, freaking Soto. He's like, so, dude, I've never seen The Shining. Is it scary? And he's like, dude, I gotta watch it through my hands. Which is funny, because later on you find out he's an 11-year-old boy. And that's one of my favorite lines when Artemis meets the rest of the crew in the real world. She's like, he's like, yeah, yeah, no, I know I'm 11. She's like, dude, come here, give me a hug. He's like, lady, ninjas don't hug. Yes.
Oh. It's like, no, she's cute. Hug her. But yeah, I don't know, man. It definitely.
Just that scene of all those guys in their haptic suits and their virtual glasses just freaking the fuck out.
Well, I just love, like, you know, that one, and then, like, any of the scenes, like, you know, the epic battle scene, and you just see, like, everybody, like, on the streets, you know, punching and kicking the air, and, you know, all of these, like, business people walking by, like, the fuck's going on? Like,
yeah, because in the final battle in the book, you know, the IOI gets there first and seals the Castle Anorak, and they pretty much do that in the movie as well. And that was one thing. I was like, how are they going to do this massive battle with like hundreds and hundreds of characters, or thousands and millions of characters in it? But, you know, they do it. You know, he's like, you know, does a broadcast. He's like, hey, you know, we have to, we can't let these assholes, you know, destroy the Oasis. Like, come fight with us. You know, here's your chance to kill Sixers. And everybody shows up. And it's just cool, like, showing the real world and everyone going down the street and you see just people on the streets, like, trying to fight and shit.
And I mean, that battle scene, I think it rivals anything that I saw in 300, Lord of the Rings. Like, I mean, it is pure epicness. Yeah, the only... And I mean, you know, just, like, I can't wait for the Blu-ray to come out because I'm just going to have to pause and, like, see how many references and stuff that I missed there. Because, I mean, there were
things. Yeah,
because
the whole time I was there, Battletoads, like, Mortal Kombat, He-Man at one point, it was, like, Transformers. There was so much shit. It was like, it was almost like there was too much stuff on the screen to my eyes to keep up with. So yeah, I need to go see it like a couple times. See,
that was probably your introduction to Infinity War.
Yeah. Oh god. And then him like in the because you know the in the book he programs a robot to blow up the device on it. But and this one, you know, since Artemis is like, you know, undercover in the IOI headquarters, she's the one that has to take it down. But the whole, like he's, like, in the freaking DeLorean, like, just driving through the battle thing. And they're, like, get to a point where he's, like, I've used up all my weapons. So people just start throwing him, like, you know, different guns from different games and stuff. And at one point, you know, Ace is, like, here, try this. And throws him, and he's, like, it's freaking Chucky. Yeah. Chucky's, like, trying to strip him. He's, like, ah. And he's, like, throw it. And he, like, throws it. And the guy's, like, holy shit, it's Chucky. And he starts stabbing the shit out of all these Sixers.
Here, try this little guy. It's like, fucking nearly wipes out because Chucky's trying to kill him.
And in the book, like as one of the through one of the gates, you earned like a robot that would become real. And you know, in the book, you know, part of that battle was these giant robot battles, which they didn't do that on the scale that they did, but they had, you know, H brought out the Iron Giant and Sorrento had Mecha Godzilla, just yeah, like in the book. So like that was a badass fight. And then there was a in the movie or in the book there was a artifact that would turn you into what the hell's that Japanese not Power Man.
Gundam.
No, in the book it was Power Man or something like it was another Japanese like superhero.
Wasn't Jaguar.
No, it wasn't. But you know, it would only last for 3 minutes. So at one point, it was cool because Daito had gotten that artifact at one point, and the whole time they're in this epic battle, he's not logging in, and they're like, "Dude, we need your help! We need your help!" And he's just basically like, "Yeah, this thing's only worth 3 minutes, so I gotta wait." And he's just waiting until like the best time, and you know, they're all getting their ass kicked by Mechagodzilla, and then in comes the freaking Serenity from Firefly, and he just, like, jumps out, like, form of Gundam and turns into the giant freaking Gundam wing robot and starts beating the shit out of Sorrento. And I was like, fuck yes.
Yeah. We almost had Firefly on the big screen. Like, that I did shows see a, it can be done.
I did see a tweet from what's his name? He's like, oh, at least Wash is still alive in the virtual world.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, there was just so much there. And I mean, I don't know. I don't really see how you're disappointed with this film. I mean, there's such a level of epicness that, you know, if you're disappointed, then I feel like you really went into it with a very closed mind.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I don't know. I've yet to talk to anybody that has shat on the film in person. I would love to, you know, have somebody that, you know, we could, you know, do a little bit of a friendly debate or something with. Because I'm just like, I just want to know the mindset. Like, I don't know.
The giant, because in the book, there's this whole epic thing where they get invited to Ogden's birthday party, which is in this giant, you know, nightclub that has no gravity and stuff. And they kind of do a little bit that in the book, they get raided by the Sixers trying to take him out. And Ogden has to step in because apparently since he was one of the designers, he's basically like a god inside the machine, can do anything, and throws them all out. But in this one, they're they think one of the keys might be hidden there, which is not. They end up just having a party, but the Sixers show in and try to kill him, and there's like this epic like fight scene breaks out. He's dressed as like Buckaroo Banzai, but his little Rubik's Cube that he bought, he's like, oh, like, you know, throws that out, and it like reverses time by like a minute or something, so it reverses time up before the attack, so they can just leave. And she's like, you just now pulled that out? He's like, yeah, it was only good for one time. It's like, I had to make sure it was worth it. You know? Yeah. And then later on, when they're in that big battle, they're pinned down at one point, and he pulls out the holy hand grenade that he bought, and they're like, holy shit, you got a holy hand grenade? How much does that cost? He's like, not as much as it's going to cost them. Like, pulls the pin and throws it. I just wish he had done the, like, got to count to three, not five. Yeah. Where's the holy book of armaments or whatever?
Yeah, like, I don't know. I mean, that was just freaking awesome. You just see all the Sixers in their, you know, freaking haptic suits just, you know, floundering around like, oh, crap. But I thought it was funny, too, you know, like, once they, you know, get to, you know, Sorrento and everything, and they're actually in his office, and, you know, he's got the password to, you know, his Oculus, like, you know, on a sticky note on the rig, and I'm like, that is such a thing I could see, you know.
Yeah, any, like corporate, like, guy. Like,
any corporate building I've been into is, like, don't tell anybody your password, but it's, like, always, like, sticky-noted under a keyboard or in a desk yes. drawer or something. It's like,
Oh, and they use that against him, too, because since they have his password, they build, like, a virtual room that looks just like his office, and as he thinks he's logging out, he's really just logging into, like, another program, and they're standing there with, like, guns to his head, like, where's Artemis? And it was very much like, you know, freaking Pulp Fiction looking shit.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, that was, I don't know, that was almost like some James Bond shit, like, you know. It's just so freaking awesome.
Oh yeah, but that whole, like, you know, that you know, epic battle too, I mean, it was just the freaking music playing. We're not going to take. I mean, yeah, it's that, and that was the other thing too. Book versus movie is things were a lot more convenient in the movie versus the book. Like in the book, like I said, since everything's spread so far out, you know, they're having to travel through space and whatever, and spending months finally. But also, you know, when it gets to the final battle and they have to finally meet somewhere in the real world that is safe so they don't get killed in the real world, they end up, you know, Ogden shows up and he's like, I've been watching you guys, you should all come to my house and I'll protect y'all while y'all defeat the bad guys. But they were all spread out, like, you know, he was in Oklahoma, Artemis was in like Vancouver, Dido and Saito were in Japan somewhere, and H was just kind of roaming the streets. But in the book, or in the movie, they're all in Columbus, Ohio. It's like, oh, y'all have been in this virtual reality for years, but y'all live like two blocks from each other. I mean, that was just slightly convenient. When they all like show up and rescue Parsifal in their van, it's like, oh yeah, she texted us, we came to pick you up. That was like 5 minutes ago. Like, you all live in the same neighborhood.
But I mean, I don't know. Like, I mean, I could see that happening in a lot of games. Like, you know, people get wrapped up and they're online identities, and you know, you're just like, oh shit, you're down the street. That's cool.
Yeah, like I said, you know, they had to make some things a little more convenient for the movie versus because, like I said, that's my only complaint, is that they kind of had to condense it down into, you know, 2 hours.
Yeah.
So it ended up seeming like this took place over like a week, maybe, where the book took place over a year, and there's like, you know, months and months of them working on stuff, where it was all just kind of like balls to the wall the whole time. For took us 5 years to find the first key, but once we found the first key, we beat the whole game in like a week.
Yeah, which I don't know. I mean, I thought it was really cool. You know, I mean, especially finding out that the quarter is a one-up coin, and
yeah, because that's the thing in the book and in the movie. There's this ultimate magical artifact called the Catalyst, which is like it's such a powerful device, it will kill everyone in the entire sector, including the user. So when it gets to the point where it looks like Parsifal and them's going to win, you know, the IOI guys, it's like, well, we can just like wipe everybody out and start over and, you know, get here first. So, you know, they detonate the bomb and it kills everybody except for magically Parsifal, like, is resurrected, and he's like, because this quarter that he's like, whatever, turned out to be an extra life. So he appears at the gate and is able to go through the final test, which that gate was pretty much the closest to the ones that are in the book, because it's yes. basically like ends up with a... It's kind of cool the way they do it in the movie, because they're like on like a frozen sheet of ice with an old TV and an old like Atari playing Adventure. And they're trying to figure out, but there's like unlimited games, so they don't know which game to use. And they're like having to go through all these games. And pretty much if you pick the wrong game, like within a minute, you die. And they just have like a whole line of Sixers playing like every single game. And he realizes is like, somebody eventually realizes it is an adventure.
Yeah, it's like, and, oh, you know, 2 minutes in, the floor hasn't collapsed, and, you know, oh, well, it must be adventure, you know?
Yeah, and the guy, the last Sixer who's playing it, makes it all the way to the end and finishes the game and then dies. And they're like, what? And the person's like, oh, no, it's not, beating the game's not the point. You have to find the Easter egg in the game, which I believe he even does that in the book. It's part of the final gate is playing adventure. And, you know, he gets to see that, like, he has to find, you know, that the original Easter egg to find the Easter egg.
But I mean it was almost like a two-parter, though, because even after you find that egg and the gate opens, you know, at that point he comes face to face with Halliday, you know, and Halliday, you know, has the pin, and it's like, you know, with this pin and this contract, you will be the sole proprietor of, you know, the Oasis to do as you wish and, you know, have all control. And, you know, I thought that was a really cool kind of, you know, check and balance, you know, that was in this.
Yeah, it was kind of like the final test, because he's like, no, wait a minute.
This isn't right at all.
Like, yeah, because Halliday, like, that's one of his biggest regrets, is him being the sole proprietor that he, you know, ended his friendship with Ogden and stuff like that. So no, I'm not signing your contract. And he's like, yes, Percival, that was your final test. And then he goes from being his like virtual avatar to actual, you know, James Halliday, and like his bedroom with all his video games and all his nerd stuff, and, you know, explaining to him like, you know, here's what you get for running the Oasis. Here's this big red button. I call it the big red button. And if you decide you should shut down the Oasis, hit this button. And then, like, it's funny because, like, in the book, they're safe in Og's, like, basement. But in the movie, he's doing all this final battle stuff while they're in H's van running from, like, Sixers in real life shooting at him. And, like, somebody hits the van and he falls and almost hits the button. And Mara's like, try not to destroy the Oasis on your first day.
Like, I don't know, man. Like, I don't know. That was a very gripping, like, you know, kind of closure to the whole film. You know, just there was that comedic element, but, you know, you're listening to Halliday and everything, and it's just like, damn. Like, you know, it's close to ending, and it's like, I don't want it to end.
But yeah, I do like that in the, you know, his first thing is like, all right, I'm going to share this with the High Five. But then also he's like, you know, because, you know, at first he's just like, I want the money because I've been a poor kid. But Artemis is the one who's like, no, the world sucks. If we have all this money and all this control, we should try to help the world. And he kind of comes to realize that himself. So, like, once he takes over, he's like, yeah, we shut down the Oasis on, like, Tuesdays and Thursdays because, you know, people need to, like, go out into the real world and work on fixing the real world. Plus, it's only the only place to get a decent meal and make out with chicks for real.
Yeah. About that. But I mean, that was the whole kind of coming of age element that I was like, that's awesome.
And like his apartment at the end, it's like he's like the richest man in the country. He could be in this giant mansion, but he has like a pretty sweet loft with like video games in the corner and a big screen TV. It's like very simple, simple life for the richest man in the world.
Dude, do you know how much it is, you know, to collect, you know, memorabilia? Okay, that shit isn't cheap. No telling how many millions were, you know, in that loft.
Kind of reminds me, was it that movie The Accountant with Ben Affleck, where he has that freaking Airstream trailer filled with, like, classic comic books and works of art, like, billions of dollars worth of shit in this little Airstream trailer with the sweet gun room in the back. I'm like, that's kind of like where I want to retire.
Yeah. But I don't know, man. Like, for me, I don't think that the story is necessarily over. Like, you know, I mean, we talked about it off air a little bit, and, you know, reading Ernest Cline's second book, Armada, even though it doesn't necessarily follow the events or anything of Ready Player One, there is still a lot of nostalgia there. But, you know, there at the end when, you know, Holiday, you know, is wrapping up his final, you know, moments, and, you know, it's like, wait a second, you're not really a hologram, are you? And he's like, nope. Then what are you? And, you know, it kind of fades. Like, you know, I wonder if that's how it segues into kind of the alien, you know, race stuff.
Either that or he's like, the Oasis is basically Holiday. He, like, digitized his mind in the, like, you know, there's, like, basically a ghost in the shell. Like, you know, his spirit lives on in the Oasis somehow. Like, you know, he's, like, you know, made himself immortal somehow by downloading himself into the Oasis. But yeah, and Ogden's character in the movie versus the book, you know, like I said, he plays like a bigger role kind of in the book, but in the movie he just kind of shows up at the end and it was like, hi, I'm, and they're like,
well,
holy shit.
I mean,
well,
you
don't realize it. Yeah. He's like, in the book he was kind of just like a, you know, could make himself invisible, and it was like watching these characters and eventually popped up when they absolutely needed him. But turns out, you know, he's like, you know, talks to him, he's like, wait a minute, he's like, I've met you before, haven't I, or something. He's like, good choice, you know, Percival. He's like, oh shit, the NPC robot butler that ran the,
yeah, the,
you know, Holiday
is...
Museum curator was actually
Og. Yeah.
He's like, you know, there's nothing in the rules of me losing a bet to a player. You know, he's like, because he's like, yeah, thanks for the quarter. That got me there. He's like, oh. There's nothing in the rules about me losing a bet. Yeah, you know, it was well within my right to help you.
Which, you know, I don't know. Like, that part there, I was just like, fuck yeah. Like,
yeah, and, like, the, yeah, it was, like I said, it was, I think, a good remake of the book. And it's kind of weird now, because you're so used to seeing everything being, somebody makes something successful, it's got to be turned into a trilogy. But this is one where, like, you know, they completed the book. There's nowhere else to go from here unless Ernest Cline writes a sequel. But I mean, it's kind of nice to see a complete story.
It's going
to
be the events of Wade and Samantha's kid, you know, and it's going to be, you know, Ready Player Two, you know,
something ridiculous like that. Yeah, because I mean, it's kind of nice seeing a complete story for once. I mean, hell, freaking the damn was it the Hobbit book. Really, it was like a small book, and they turned that into a trilogy of movies. I mean, it's like, you know, Hollywood wants to nurse every nickel and dime out of a project. I'm surprised they didn't like make each key its own movie.
Yeah.
But it's kind of nice to see a complete story for once.
Yes, and
there's no downloadable content. I didn't have to buy any expansion packs
or the season pass. But I don't know. You know, I think about gaming communities, you know, today. And you know, the one thing that I was kind of waiting on was the throwback to Leroy Jenkins. Like, you know, just the one person,
battle,
you know,
Leroy
running
Jenkins.
In solo. Leroy Jenkins! God damn it, Leroy!
Oh, but the freaking Chucky. But yeah, like I said, I really have to rewatch it just to see.
Oh, yeah. I am sure that there are probably hundreds of, you know, subtle references that we missed. Like, I mean, there's just so much to take in. Like, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how you hate it. Like, I really don't. I mean.
Oh, and I did like, you know, in the book, you know, when he finally meets his best friend, H, turns out, you know, she's a woman. And, you know, and has to, like, you know, tell. But I like how it kind of pulled it in the movie, because at one point, you know, he's like, you know, in love with Artemis, and he's like, bro, she's probably like a 300-pound dude named Chuck living in their mama's basement. So when he's like fleeing from the Sixers in the real world, you know, H kind of like tackles him, and he's like, who the fuck? And she's like, I'm a 300-pound man named Chuck living in my mama's basement. They're like, oh shit, H.
Yes,
that's how they like knew each other. And then, like, you know, the kids come out, and like, you know, yeah, they've been ninjas in the game. Like, one of them comes out with a baseball bat, walking that thing like a samurai sword, busting up drones. But I mean, overall, like I said, it was like it's different enough that it was an almost an original story, but it was it had the heart of the book and yes. enough of the references that it, I'm like, all right, I'm not going to call bullshit on this movie. I'm sold on it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for this film, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it had me captivated and, you know, I mean, very much the way, you know, when I would read the book, you know, I mean, hell, those are some of the greatest years that I can think of, you know, fucking playing video games, not having, you know, all the fucking responsibilities and shit that come with adulthood. So, I mean.
And there was another small thing, too. Like, in the book, you know, Artemis keeps telling him, oh, I'm ugly in the real world. You don't want to meet me. And when he meets her, he finds out she has, like, a birthmark on her face. And he's like, it's not that big a deal. But that meeting her in the real world happened much earlier in the film. And he's still like, you know, it's a freaking birthmark. You know, you're still beautiful. I still, like, you know, love you or whatever. But her character in the Oasis, when you first see her, she's, like, one way. But then after that meeting where he tells her, like, you should, you know, be happy to be different and whatnot, when you see her avatar later, her avatar has still looks like her avatar, but she has like the eye discolorations like her, like she does in the real world, like later on. I thought that was kind of just a cool little detail they put in there. So as we kind of end the chapter of this game, movie, book, what do you think of this here cigar?
Much like the movie, I don't want the cigar to end, and that's kind of weird saying, you know, remembering that this is a Macanudo and some of the thoughts that I've had on previous cigars. This thing has been a absolute delight to smoke. It's peppery, it's complex, it's, you know, full flavor. I'm enjoying the ever-living shit out of it.
And one final, is there anything in the book that you didn't get in the movie that you're disappointed that you didn't get to see that on the big screen?
I don't really know because, you know, after seeing just the trailers and everything, like I already had it in my head that, hey, things are going to be vastly different. And, you know, I don't really think that I wanted the film to try to follow the book. You know, because there were certain things that I think I did a better job in my imagination than they would have been, you know, on the big screen. Or I would have had in my head, hey, this should have been done this way, but it was done another way.
I got to say, though, you know, I'm kind of disappointed there wasn't an epic Rush concert to unlock a gate like there was in the book.
I mean,
there was no him having to play a Rush song on a
guitar. But I will say, from the start of that film, I mean, films in the last 3 years have just been balls to the wall with the soundtracks, and this film is no exception.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it just, I don't know. I want the soundtrack to go along with the book or something, you know? Yes.
And as we said before, like, after the movie, I wanted to reread the book. I just didn't have time, so I did download the Audible book, and yeah, hearing Will Wheaton read this is, I mean, he does voices for each of the characters. It's highly entertaining. You should definitely check that out. And with that, I think it's time for a beer. Hey man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Booze Hounds return.
And welcome back to the podcast. It's time for Beer 30. What are we drinking this week, Brad? Almost said smoking.
Well, we're smoking, but we're also drinking. So Up now, we've got L. Smith Brewing Company's Speedway Stout.
Yeah, to kind of go with that epic race sequence from Ready Player One, we've got a racing-themed beer.
Yeah, and I definitely don't recommend getting behind the wheel, whether it be a roadway or a speedway, after having a couple of these, because this bad boy clocks in at 12% ABV.
Yeah, and it is black as the Ace of Spades. It looks like...
It looks like motor oil.
Yeah, it looks like motor oil after a 500-mile race.
But, I mean, apparently, you know, this ominous, you know, black pitch is, you know, kind of what this beer has... you know, been made famous for. I mean, not only that, but just looking at this on the shelf, I've passed over this beer half a dozen times, if not more, you know, strictly like, man, this is going to be some redneck, you know, beer. And dude, I am blown away by, you know, what is in my glass right now.
Yeah. And from L. Smith Brewing Company, and I do like, you know, how some craft beers, this one actually has the glass recommendation and a serving temperature recommendation. Drink fresh in a goblet at 50 to 55 degrees.
Yeah, and, you know, this is going to come in at 70 IBUs, so not, you know, very bitter. But, I mean, just the flavor on this, I mean, the chocolate, the malt, you know, there's notes of toffee and caramel there. I mean, dude, this has just been... this is an awesome beer, and it's crazy because at 12%, it is surprisingly easy to drink, therefore making this very dangerous.
Yeah, you do have, there's a little bit of a boozy taste to it, but not as strong as some beers at that percentage I've
No, had. In fact, I mean, the mouthfeel is actually... like, it almost feels like it's on nitro because, I mean, it's creamy, and I don't know. I mean, dude.
Yeah, not only do they, you know, this, they're based in, I believe, San Diego, so not only does it have, like, tons of chocolate and roasted malts, it has some locally roasted coffee from Ryan Brothers Coffee Incorporated to, you know, bring up that... dark chocolatey notes to it. I mean, it is black as some, like, beyond black Black Rifle coffee cup. I mean, it is black.
Ah, oh, but it is delicious. Oh my gosh. You know, some food pairing recommendations would be, you know, beef jizz dishes with
did you say beef jizz?
I mean, maybe like some charboiled, you know, testes? I don't know, man. Yeah, I mean, it could be a thing.
Some Rocky Mountain oysters.
Yeah. So, you know, char-grilled foods, chocolate and vanilla desserts, salty blue cheese, aged Gouda. I mean...
hard and nutty cheeses.
And cloth-bound cheddars. So, if you like to pair food with your beer, I more so pair cigars. I don't know. I'm not really I like beer for beer. Like, I always feel like I'm doing a disservice when I'm eating with it. So I might be missing out on something there. But, you know, several different, you know, medals that have been won. You know, a 2008 silver medal at the American Beer Festival for aged beer. The 2012 San Diego International Beer Competition for Imperial Stout. They got gold. And then... gold again at the International Beer Competition Imperial Stout. Wow, this thing is already creeping up on me. Holy crap.
Yeah, you know, science and news, we're just going to be like freaking mumbling and drooling on ourselves.
So. Yeah, pretty much. Wow.
Yeah, because we, yeah, a little behind the scenes, we had a pretty strong stout while we were recording the main segment, not realizing the review beer was also a 12% beer, so... We might be a little drunk by the end of this episode.
Are we going to be Ready Player One? Pass the controller, man.
Now we need to play some drunken Mario Kart.
Yeah, there we go. You know, well, I mean, I do have GoldenEye, so, I mean, we can always do some slap matches.
Goddamn slap matches. I love those. Those like, just like the intensest thing, just running each other slap.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
All right, so for me, I'm at a 5. Yeah. I don't do that often, but holy crap.
Fucking 5. Like I said, I'd not heard of L. Smith before picking this up, and we're just like, hey, it's about racing. There's a racing sequence. That'll tie in. But yeah, this was a good a good pull.
This was a heavy pull.
yeah.
But a delicious one. So with that, we will be back with some science.
Yeah, science. And welcome back. It's time for some science. You ready to learn some things, man?
Like how to sober up, you mean, or what?
Nah.
I don't think I have the mental stability to absorb and
retain
and
learn. Come on, man. If we learn nothing from Beer Fest, it's drunken recall. Next time you get drunk, you'll remember all of this stuff.
All right, I'm game. Let's go. Make sure it's good, because I don't want to remember stupid shit.
Well, anyone who has worn glasses are familiar with the transition lenses that go from clear to like sunglasses once sun hits them. Well, Johnson & Johnson has teamed up with the inventors of that transitions optical to make automatically darkening contact lenses. So people who wear contacts don't have to wear sunglasses.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's like the original lenses work with like photochromatic molecules that basically once they're hit with sunlight, they reconfigure themselves to absorb more sunlight and become darker, which is going to look weird as shit in a contact lens.
I don't know. I mean, maybe.
I mean, anyone
dude, I walk the streets of Dragon Con, okay? I see lenses of all varieties, so, I mean...
True enough. But, I mean, anyone who's a fan of Supernatural knows all the demons have black eyes. So, yeah, it's going to be weird as shit walking down the street, and all of a sudden you see somebody's eyes turn black. You're like, fuck, it's a demon!
Yeah. Better call Van Helsing.
But then again, if it's going to be hard as shit to, do HGN roadside sobriety during the daytime. So, if you have the blacked out lenses, great time to day drink. That's all I'm saying. It's going to be harder to look at your eyes.
We do not advocate day drinking. All right, day drinking is absolutely an awesome thing. Granted, you don't go out and try to kill people.
So, like, I got to prep for Dragon Con. Got to get my liver in shape. We only got,
170 days, maybe? Another
4 months, roughly. Time to find a room.
Where does the time go?
Yeah, we just got our media passes for this year, so now it's time to find a place to sleep. We probably should have.
People sleep at Con?
We probably should have done that earlier, but if it's not us looking for a room at the last minute, it's not Dragon Con.
Hey, we always come out on top somehow.
Yeah, but these lenses apparently they've been working on this for the last 10 years, and it has finally cleared the FDA and should be available sometime in the first half of 2019.
That'll be awesome.
And and it's not going to be they're supposedly going to be the same like 2 week disposable contacts that you're already getting. So, it's not going to be a huge expensive adjustment. It's going to be pretty much just an option in their regular disposable contact line.
I'll be sure anybody I know that wears contacts gets this information by listening to the Cigar Nerds podcast.
Yeah, I just wonder how this is going to look in real life, because that's going to be kind of weird.
Maybe not.
Well, another thing... Elon Musk and people are doing a lot of, they always say, they can't hear you scream in space. Well, they also can't hear you jizz in space. NASA is sending a lot of sperm to the International Space Station to see if we can make babies in space.
Does that make them alien races at that point?
Maybe. Yes, a current experiment, I think it's called like the Micro 2 mission. Basically, they're shipping both human and bull sperm to the station to see if, you know, weightlessness and microgravity affects the viability of sperm. Yeah, the Micro 11 missions on the SpaceX Dragon cargo craft scheduled to make a, you know, journey there soon. Because basically there is, like, I guess, a certain chemical that activates sperm and deactivates it and, you know, causes it to do its swimming. But, you know, they're worried that apparently in, you know, gravity experiments here on Earth, you know, they're basically the stopping of them or something. They're apparently you can't swim as well in space is what they've discovered. So they're, you know, taking these samples to the space station and going to activate them in space and then bring them back to Earth to study them to see if, you know, they could still, you know, do their job in space. Because, you know, with all this whole, like, we're going to have to move to Mars someday and, you know, space travel is the future as the Earth dies, you know, doesn't going to do us a whole lot of good if we, you know, leave the planet and then can't reproduce and we just all kind of age out and die.
Yep. I could see that being a problem. So did you donate some jizz for science?
I don't know where I signed up for that experiment, but yeah, you know, I'll donate some.
Little Joe Martian.
Alien Nation. Wow. Well, you know, as long as you're doing stuff in space, speaking of making a mess in space, Elon Musk is...
We're not talking about space bukkake, are we?
I mean, that could be a whole nother, like, you know, category on Pornhub.
It's out of this world, man.
Oh. Well, one of the most dangerous things in space travel, if you, you know, look into it, the space is full of junk. Like, we have been dropping stuff and causing, you know, between old satellites and spacecrafts, there is like a huge amount of space junk. Some of it orbiting the Earth at 30,000 miles per hour, which even the smallest little screw in space traveling that speed will go right through whatever spacecraft. So as we do more and more space travel and more junk ends up there, you know, it's, you know, kind of becoming dangerous for space travel. So one of the things that we've got to figure out how to do is how to clean up the space.
We haven't even figured out how to do that with our own home planet.
But Elon Musk and SpaceX is trying a new experiment in April. They're launching a space junk removal system known as Remove Debris, which is an inventive name for the for the project, in conjunction with scientists at the University of Surrey. But one of the things it's weird about this is they had to bring their own junk for the experiment because apparently it's against the law for an outside entity to touch debris that belongs to other space programs, even if it's no longer in use. So currently it's illegal.
So even in space, bureaucracy gets in the way of common sense and just, hey, let's get some shit done.
Yeah, so NASA can clean up NASA shit, but, you know, outside agencies can't touch other agencies' space junk. So they had to...
I mean, can't we just collect it and then, you know, hey, here's some shit from the Soviets, so here you go, have your shit back. Like,
or just, like, destroy it, you know, burn it all up in the atmosphere, which is pretty much what this thing does. Yeah, the remove debris is testing three different techniques. One of them is basically a giant net that they launch into space that, you know, gathers up the shit and then kind of slows it down enough where it will burn up upon reentry. They have another device for, I guess, bigger objects that will actually launch a harpoon into whatever and then, you know, reel it back in. And once it's, you know, collected all the garbage it can collect, it has, it's also testing basically a space parachute that will launch this giant drag sail, which will slow the satellite down till it reenters orbit and burns up in in orbit. So basically, this thing is designed to go up there, collect as much junk as it can, and then pull that stuff back down where it's, you know, harmlessly broken up in the atmosphere.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
Or we have a meteorite full of space shit coming down at us at 30,000 miles per hour, and, you know, it's a man-made Apollo 13.
Yeah. Look, it's a shooting star. Oh, no, that's a space toilet.
Oh, hell.
Oh. Mm.
Speaking, can we talk about the effects of alcohol in the human body? Because I'm feeling it.
Well, there are a few beer companies that are trying to brew beer in space, so it's related. And speaking of dumb things, a recent survey, I mean, we've joked about snowflake culture and just dumb stuff. Apparently, only 66% of young adults in America accept that Earth is round.
I mean,
that's way too huge of a number.
Is it? Is it? Is it really?
This world is fucked. That
which is why we're trying to colonize Mars, so we can fuck it too. I mean,
it's just you see these flat Earth people on the internet, and you're like, God, these people are stupid. This
no,
is like
you know what I think it is. I think it's the most well-designed 36%. Troll group that there is.
You know, according to the survey, it suggests that, you know, 84% have always believed the world is round. But according to 18 to 24-year-olds, however, that percentage falls to 60%. And anyone, like, above that, you know, like older groups, it raises to 94% for people, like, 55 and above that are like, y'all are all stupid.
Get off my lawn.
Yeah. I'm only 39, but I'm starting to, you know, feel for these people and I know why you're wanting the kids to get off your lawn now.
But then again, have you been to space to verify that the Earth is in fact round?
I saw Elon Musk's, like, you know, freaking Tesla in space. That shit looked round to me.
How do you know those images weren't simulated?
I did see a tweet earlier, someone who was, I believe it was Mount Everest. Someone like took a picture from the top of Mount Everest. I mean, it was like one of the tallest mountains in the world. And it was so high up that in the selfie, you could actually see the curvature of the Earth on the horizon. He was so high. And he was like, suck it, flat earthers. I was like, that is brilliant.
Photoshopped.
Yeah. We got this other idiot like that tried to launch himself in a homemade rocket to prove that the Earth is flat. I mean, we're all doomed.
Nah, dude, you just see, here's the problem is for some reason we've decided to coddle instead of let natural selection do its process. And, you know, preventing natural selection from weeding out the stupidity, we have dumbed down the masses. So, I mean,
yeah, it was that time when, you know, we had to start using the electric socket protectors. And all the playgrounds were made with, like, rubber mats and load. Like I said, you know, back in the day, the stupid people burned out early. So it was, like, literally survival of the fittest. We've by making things safer, we've allowed too many idiots to survive. It's kind of like the movie Idiocracy. The more and more I see, like, the movie, the more I see around me, the movie Idiocracy is becoming absolutely true. The dumb are surviving longer than they should. And populating the Earth faster than the rest of us.
And with that,
at this point, I'm kind of looking forward to our eventual robot apocalypse. just go ahead and finish this. We don't deserve to to be dominant species anymore.
And with that,
time for some news.
Welcome to the Soul Forge. A place of silent mystery, quiet contemplation, and outright mayhem. Join your host, Sean Vanderloo, as he guides you through the adventures of living. Together, we'll talk about life and love, sex and dating, joy and heartache, memories and loss, and so much more. Don't worry, it's not nearly as pretentious as it sounds. get ready for life, the universe, and everything on the Soul Forge.
SoulForgePodcast.com.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News.
News.
What you laughing about, my friend?
Oh.
My state of inebriation?
A very special episode of the Growing Age Podcast.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, well, it wouldn't be very special without talking a very special franchise near and dear to all of our hearts, and that being Star Wars. But in this case, it is a solo film about Han Solo.
It's not a standalone film. It's a solo film.
Yes, exactly.
Hashtag dad joke.
But yeah, so we got our, another look at the Han Solo movie. And, you know, to me, this is gearing up to look much more like a Rogue One or something. Like, I mean, and
it's pretty bad at this point that the standalone films, I think, are more entertaining than the new Star Wars films. Because, I don't know, the old stuff kind of, it looks more like traditional Star Wars than the new shit we've gotten.
Yeah, well, I mean, looking at this trailer and everything, and I mean, just seeing, you know, Han meet, you know, Chewie for the first time and stuff, I mean, and
I gotta say, is it Daniel Glover, the new Lando, freaking brilliant choice, yes, for Lando. A young, cocky Lando, like, that's exactly that, you know, and he could be a young Billy Dee Williams.
Well, I mean, that was the thing. It's like, you
know, he's going to be doing Colt 45 commercials.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about some of the other films, and all right, they've been watchable. But, I mean, for me, Rogue One was one of those films that
it had actual stormtroopers in it.
Well, I mean, not only that, but then, too, like, the space battles, the action, and everything, yes, of that nature. Like, I mean, that is what I love Star Wars for. And
yeah, the Rogue One had the scale, I think, of a Star Wars movie, just the space fighting, where the other two movies, they've been good, but they've not been great.
Yeah. we've mentioned before, you know, if you're still 30 years into the battle, is your, you know, Rebellion really as good as you say? I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, and I don't know. I mean, for me, I've always liked the scum and the villainy aspect of Star Wars, and, you know, more of the scavengers and that type
that
of thing.
And I want to see stories about my heroes. I don't give a fuck about Rey and Finn.
Not yet. But I mean, you know, 20 years down the road.
Kylo's a bitch. like I said, the new movies are made for the new generation. Like, I'm tired of seeing my heroes die or act like bitches. Damn kids, get off my island.
Absolutely. So, I don't know. I mean, to me, I look forward to it. I've seen, you know, the opposite side of the spectrum, and I tend to kind of disagree. I mean,
I'm kind of worried about the new guy playing Han, because that role is such iconically Harrison Ford, but, you know, the rest of the characters, the rest of the action we've seen so far looks good. So,
but I mean,
I'm going to give him a chance.
Even then, all right, you know, Harrison Ford, absolutely iconic. Will not argue with you on that point. But, I mean, Harrison Ford trying to pretend that he's, you know, 20 years younger, does that ego kind of get in the way of things, you know? I mean,
he doesn't have, like, the just the cockiness of Han, or at least from the trailers we've seen. But then again, it is a young Han Solo. He's very much a brash rookie. He's not the kind of world-weary veteran smuggler that we that we know. So, like I said, I will give him a Chewie looks cool. I mean,
yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think I,
even though it's not, you know,
I have failed in my OG parenting, by the way. Like, we were watching, you know, Jumanji, and the trailer for, you know, Han had come on, and, you know, you hear Chewie and my girlfriend's kids, you know, what is that? It's funny. And I'm like, I failed. So, a Star Wars.
While my stepkid has a full, like, you know, Darth Vader pajama outfit. So I'm teaching them the ways of the Force.
And more power to you. I'm learning. I don't know. I mean, I just don't know. So, you know, switching gears onto more Marvel news, since everything now is Disney.
I did like one thing from that new trailer, though, where he's like, you know, Han's in the cockpit, you know, and he's like, they're in some kind of shit, and Chewie's in the back, like, saying something. And he's like, since when do you know how to fly? You're 190-year-old? You look great.
Not even great. Not even a smidgen.
No. Wookiees age well. I wish I aged like a Wookiee.
So up next, Marvel's Jessica Jones has been renewed for a third season. You know, I know we talked about earlier kind of why, because I think, you know, season two, you know, I haven't seen it through its entirety, so please don't spoil it. But
I've finished season two, and it seemed like, well, season one, there was a lot of, like, loose ends that you're like, all right, there's, you know, and a lot of that they, like, seems like they just threw away, like, the whole mystery of the cop who became, like, a fucking rage road monster, you know, that kind of wrapped up way too quickly, and this season was more about finding out how Jessica became, dealing more with her backstory of how she became who she is and the consequences of that. So, I mean, it kind of put a bow on it to me. Like, I think they finished her story. So there wasn't a whole lot of like loose ends maybe for this season. I'm like, I don't know where, because previously everything has been kind of not only building toward more backstory, but also toward the Defenders series. So with this being the first post-Defender series, it's like, I think they kind of wrapped up her storyline, so I'm not sure where the series is going to go from
here.
Well,
I tell you where it goes.
Okay.
And I think a meme did it, you know, exceptionally well. Thanos has snapped his finger, everything that we know in the MCU has reset, and there was just a big black screen and a bunch of people wondering, what the fuck?
Kind of like the end of The Sopranos.
Exactly. So, I don't know. I mean, you know. I think at this point, kind of all bets are off. But, I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, there's so much going on in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah, because you're right. That is going to be a post-Thanos series. So, yeah, there may be some collateral damage in New York they're dealing with. Yeah, so, yeah, I'm interested to see who the new big bad is. Because, yeah, there really wasn't a whole lot of clues through this season of where they're going to go from here.
Well, you know, moving right along, the MCU's Ghost Rider cast is apparently the new Terminator. So Gabrielle Luna is now going to be the sixth entry in James Cameron's Terminator franchise.
Yeah, well, actually, I've not heard a lot about this new Terminator series he's doing, but I like it's back to him being in charge of it. So at least it's the OG guy running the show, so maybe it won't be as bad as the last couple Terminator movies.
Yeah, and I mean, this is kind of set place to
and
take...
I liked him as Ghost Rider, so he's a decent actor. So
yeah,
we'll see.
I mean, you know, he's definitely got cred. And, you know, Terminator 6, it's kind of weird, is actually going to take place after the events of Terminator 2.
Yeah, I've heard it's more of a sequel to Judgment Day than it has anything to do with, like, the previous movies that have gone... James Cameron's like, all right, I have the rights back. All that shit that happened after this movie didn't happen.
Yeah.
It's great when you're doing like time travel movies. You can just like, yeah, all that other shit. That's a different branch in the whole multiverse.
Yeah. So this looks like, you know, it's, you know, going to be, you know, coming to, it is set to come August, you know, or I'm sorry, November 22nd of 2019. That's still a long time away, but
yeah.
You know, no titles, no nothing yet, but I'm like you, though. I mean, he's been a legitimate actor, you know, did a good Ghost Rider. Over to the Terminator. I mean, I could see it.
I don't know if he's going to be, like, bad Terminator or good Terminator, you know. I just don't know about hearing, come with me if you want to live, in, like, a Spanish accent. It's just,
overdub it, you know.
Used to Arnold.
But, I mean, I think you're going to get...
At least the Hasta La Vista will sound a whole lot more authentic. Hasta La Vista. Bitch.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, we're going to get Schwarzenegger and Laura Hamilton, you know, and starring role, you know. they're set to come back. I don't know. You know, like you said, you know, it's James Cameron saying, fuck this shit, here it comes, and, you know, we're going to do it right.
I want to see the Ghost Rider come back to Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I mean, I liked that run on last season. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. You know, switching gears onto something completely different. I came across this the other day, and apparently for Universal's Halloween Horror Nights in 2018, they're going to have an entire Stranger Things theme.
I may have to make a road trip.
Yeah.
I want to go to the Stranger Things haunted house. Cause now that I'm kind of a retired haunt actor because Netherworld moved and it's too far for me to go down there. This year I'm looking for, because back in the day before I became like a haunt actor, I used to hit every single haunted house I could. But then when I started working, I never had time. So now that I have time again, I want to hit some haunted houses this season. So I need to go to
Universal. Well, I mean, Universal's Halloween Horror Nights have always kind of been one of those bucket item list for me. But, you know, here it looks like, you know, they say the guests will experience iconic scenes and characters, including, you know, Hawkins National Library, the buyer home.
The snack stand has to serve chocolate pudding.
I'm sure.
I found the pudding.
You know, you're going to get the upside down woods.
Eggos and pudding, man. They have to have that in the snack shack.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's kind of cool, too, because Universal Studios is actually working with the executive producers. So you're going to get Matt Duffer, Ross Duffer, Sean Levy. So I don't know. I mean, you know, looks like starting on Friday, September 14th in Hollywood and Orlando and Friday, September 28th in Singapore. So, you know, they've got a little short video that we'll link to. And, I mean, to me, it looks straight out of the movie or the, you know, freaking Netflix series. So, I don't know. It's something that, as kind of a haunt fan, I would look forward to.
Yeah, if I could make that trip happen, I'd love to see that.
And, you know, as we switch gears again, so we talked about the epic fight battle in, you know, Ready Player One and how that has probably been theatrically one of the, you know, although short segmented, one of the, you know, most epic battles I've seen in a long time. Well, apparently Game of Thrones has just filmed the largest and longest battle sequence in TV history.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they held the previous record, too, like the whatever Battle of the Bastards or whatever it was. That was a pretty big thing to film. So, yeah, this is going to be huge.
Yeah, absolutely. So, apparently, this was like a 55-night-long shoot, you know, for this Winter one particular coming. Battle. And, I mean, you know, most films don't even take that length of time to film. So, yeah. I mean, it's like, holy crap.
Yeah, that's going to be huge.
Yeah, I mean, that is absolutely insane. So, I don't know. I mean, you know, Game of Thrones has really kind of tipped the scales in a lot of ways. This might be the end-all to end-all. I don't know.
Yep.
Like, I'm sure there's probably some kind of world record that, you know, this film will end up taking. Harsh TV series. HBO series. Because there's a lot of boobs.
You're drunk.
I am drunk. It's awesome. How are we doing so far? We're chugging lighter on, right along. Wow. And now.
Oh, this is a great episode.
For something completely different. Amazon. For, you know, their series, you know, because we can't just have Netflix and Hulu dominate the market.
Keep forgetting
that
I have Amazon. I keep forgetting they have their own network.
Well, maybe this will, you know, be a reviving light. Because I know as a kid, I thoroughly enjoyed this show. But a Rocky and Bullwinkle show is actually in the works from Amazon Prime Video. So, I mean, it's supposed to be a modern take, you know, basically.
Ooh, Rocky?
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I'm wondering, you know, those were icons back in the 50s and 60s. I mean, I saw a lot of them on Saturday morning cartoons and, you know, later on through different network series and that type of things. But I'm wondering how in the modern age...
As long as we have a bad Russian going moose and squirrel, I'm sold.
I don't know, man. The way things are going with the Russians right now, I don't know that we're going to get that. I don't know. I mean...
A Rocky fighting ISIS.
I think that's a completely different gambit, but I don't know. But apparently Tara Strong will be the voice of Rocky.
Sweet.
You know, so... and a newcomer, you know, for Bullwinkle will be Brad Norman. You know, I'm not sure. Hopefully it works out. I don't know that, you know, Amazon has quite had the mass appeal that a lot of the Netflix series and stuff have had, but...
Yeah, because it's just so much more expensive to have than Netflix, because you got to have it be an Amazon Prime member, which is, what, $100 or so?
I don't know.
But yeah, it's like, you know, with Netflix, it's, it seems more of the you know, standard. But I mean, I watched a couple episodes of Tick. I need to finish that. So, I mean, they some of their original stuff has been pretty cool. I just have not, I keep forgetting I have it in the massive digital
and,
things
and
they
maybe
have.
Maybe that is just a, you know.
Like, to me, Amazon is still the place I go to buy stuff, not watch TV.
and that may be a, you know, sign of how their marketing stands up to the marketing of the Netflix. But then again, a lot of the Netflix stuff has been tried and proven. So, no. I mean, who knows? All right. I hate to end on a downer, but this is something that just came across my news feed.
It literally popped up while we were recording.
Yeah, but apparently the great... Arlie Ermey has passed away, and this has been confirmed on multiple sources, citing, you know, his you know, longtime manager, Bill Roggen, that, you know, at 74 years old, complications of pneumonia, he has passed.
Yeah, I mean, that sucks. I mean, we did a whole one of our Stanley Kubrick episode and talked about Full Metal Jacket, and the dude has just been like, not only iconic as an actor, but iconic as just himself playing the gunny.
I mean you think of somebody...
His History Channel show and then whatever, Lock and Load. And, I mean, all that stuff was, like, just great. Like, you know, he's almost more famous for being himself and his epic rants than being, like, you know, his acting roles.
And, you know, you're talking about somebody that, you know, has supported the men and women in uniform. There is no other, you know.
Big supporter of, you know, Second Amendment and, you know, and also, like, has worked with Glock for, like, you know, as someone who owns, like, five Glocks and probably my favorite hand. He's made, like, just these cool, epic Glock commercials, like, you know, has worked for Team Glock and he's been a big, strong supporter of the military, strong supporter of the firearm industry, and... Some of the most iconic movie roles, because the Gunnery Sergeant Hartman is one of those characters that, you know, anybody who tries to play a badass drill sergeant is kind of like, you know, compared to Arlie Ermey, and he's like just, you know, one of those, you know, American icons.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's a little quote, you know, from Full Metal Jacket that, you know, is very famous, but it's actually the Rifleman's Creed, and, you know, it states, "This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine." And to this toast,
raise your glasses and raise your Glocks for Arlie Ermey.
And you can never toast without actually taking a drink, by the way. Just a little etiquette. But yeah, that bit of sad news. So, you know, with that.
You can check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com. We're also on the ESO Network at ESOPodcast.com. And several of our other sister shows, I know, you know, the ESO Podcast and a couple of other shows have done Ready Player One episodes. So if you don't like our opinion, go check out some of our other episodes on the network and see what they thought of the movie.
And actually, too, one of the things that, you know, is relatively new to the network is the Patreon account. You know, and that's where, you know, you can get some premium content.
Yeah, pretty much all the shows are kind of doing Patreon exclusive. We have not recorded one yet, but it's on the to-do list. But yeah, there's, like I said, it's kind of a cool little extra if you're a fan of the network. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Strikeforceenergy.com, promo code Cigar Nerds. Also, if you want some cool merchandise, we have a Zazzle store link to our website. We also have shirts on realmensmokecigars.com. And also remember, ninjas don't hug. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping through Amazon.com or the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.